Thank you, Greg. Well, I'm going to continue the in the vein that Andy Fabian started with yesterday in trying to represent reality for all the theorists in the audience. And in fact, we've got quite a morning session of details about the X-ray transients. And what I'm going to cover are principally the what we can learn from the principally from the optical and the infrared, and what physical parameters about the black holes or the compact objects that we can deduce from them. The X-ray properties and comparisons with neutron stars and their QPO behavior will be covered by Gene Swank, and you'll hear about the radio and JETS observations after the break. Now, this is a field, of course, that unlike the one discussed yesterday, about 15 years ago, we basically just had one object that in the galaxy that we thought was a black hole, which of course is Cygnus X1. And even that about that, there was a lot of argument because, of course, its big problem is its massive companion. Nevertheless, I think most of us actually believe that CX1 does contain a black hole, but that's not one of the transients and not going to be my main topic today. The key thing is that its properties, as Gene will describe, gave us a guide to searching for other black hole candidates, even though in many circumstances neutron stars can mimic them. That we've known for a long time, and I'll show you in a moment, that LMXBs, low mass X-ray binaries, are much better for at least measuring the compact object mass because the companion star is of such low mass. The problem is all the previously known LMXBs is that the companion star, which you need to be able to study the compact object, is completely invisible because of the X-ray illuminated accretion disk. Also, of course, for good black hole candidates, we want to be able to say absolutely certainly we have compact object in excess of 3 solar masses, the neutron star limit that Andy mentioned yesterday. But let me just remind you of the actual results from pulsar measurements, that whilst we keep saying that 3 solar masses is the maximum mass of a neutron star, actually there's a slightly more updated version of this now that I saw recently. There is no neutron star confirmed mass. These are all from binaries, which exceeds 2 solar masses. Even some of these error bars down here have reduced recently. And so it may actually be that this constraint is too conservative because of the observations. And as Jeff McClintock said in his review a little over 10 years ago, that the what we ideally want are objects whose mass function exceeds 5 solar masses, his holy grail. This is a field which has changed really quite dramatically in the last 5 or 6 years. So the things that we're going to be talking about today, these X-ray transients, do give us an opportunity for the complete solution of the binary parameters, and that's what I'll be going through shortly. So just a quick schematic for those of you who haven't come across this field before, the X-ray transients. I tend to call them soft X-ray transients. Others call them X-ray novae. The only reason I don't like this is just to remind you this has nothing to do with the classical novae that involved the white dwarfs. In outburst, then, we've got a cool a companion which has transferred and continues to transfer material, even quiescence, into an accretion disk, which undergoes an almost classical outburst, producing a large X-ray outburst and a consequently bright accretion disk. At some later point, usually up to 6 months later, the system is in quiescence. The large optical range here tells us that we're dealing with low-mass X-ray binaries. And so this is the basic picture to keep in mind, and you'll be I'll be concentrating on what we can learn from the companion star, and the X-ray properties will come later on this morning. Now what I've done is actually put on a single view graph what I think are the key observational properties. I'm going to leave this one up because I will give you details of each aspect of this. So think of this talk as a kind of the mechanical analog of what Mitch Begelman did yesterday electronically, in which I will flip between these two. But hopefully with readable numbers. Sorry, Mitch. Okay, the basic light curves then, this is one of the few X-ray light curves I'll show you. It's a collection of four of the classical X-ray transients. The prototype, of course, is AO620-00, which went off in 1975. Still, I believe, the brightest X-ray source ever detected, three times the strength of SCOEX-1 at its peak. The other one on here, which I will talk quite a bit about, which Andy mentioned yesterday, was V404 Cygni, which is this one here. Apart from the large variability early on, it basically showed the same time scale for the decays. There's a log-log plot, so these are exponential decays, and the details are in those review papers there. This is a more recent compendium that Eric Kulkas has put together in a recent review in New Astronomy Reviews. The X-ray light curves in each case are along the bottom, but we now have the optical light curves shown along the top. And these are the key properties in terms of peak luminosities, the amplitude range, and the number that we sort of find per year. When I first put this down a couple of years ago, we were going through a dry spell of transients in spite of having the appropriate monitoring capability. But certainly in this last year, the sky seems to have gone berserk with far more than this average. But over the last 20 years, it seems to have been about something like that. Now in terms of the amplitude, here's the peak for J422 at about 13th magnitude, and in quiescence it's actually down around here below 21, and that's similar range for all of these. Last year, Tariq Shabazz and Eric Kulkas noted that there's an interesting correlation between the amplitude, that amplitude range, and the subsequent orbital period that's found. And in that basic, the basic idea is quite simple, and that is that in the longer orbital periods, you have a larger star filling its Roche lobe, and so the secondary star is brighter. And this just compares the change in brightness of the disk, it's this dashed line, orbital period increasing along here, and that of the secondary star. So at shorter orbital periods, you get a larger amplitude, which is basically that, and that decreases. This is actually very useful. It means that even during the outburst, if the this really only works well for periods less than about a day, but it still gives a very immediately. If you just look at the sky survey to see what the star was before, you see what its peak was, and you could use this as a guide to the kind of orbital period that you might expect. This appeared in MN at the end of last year. And the other feature of the light curves there is the secondary maximum, which I forgot to point out in that overall one, but I'll show you some more in a moment. A recent paper I did with Tariq and Andrew King, who's here, on the SXT light curves. This followed on from a paper by King and Ritter, who basically interpreted the SXT outbursts as being the same as those in CVs. That is, you've got some kind of thermal viscous instability in the accretion disk. But of course, in CVs, that's shut off via a cooling front. Whereas the one difference with the SXTs is that you're dealing with much, much higher X-ray radiation, a factor of 1,000, 10,000 times brighter at least than CVs. And this radiation can heat the disk and prolong the outburst. This is a topic I'm sure is going to come up in the working groups. The effect of this is to produce a much longer exponential tail and stop the cooling front. And they propose that this means that you could actually empty the entire disk. Consequently, you get long recurrence times, which is exactly what we see in the X-ray transients compared to CVs. And they also pointed out that there's a critical luminosity to ionize the disk because in the neutron star systems, you're dealing with a point source, whereas in the X-ray, in the black hole systems, you have you don't have that point source, but an extended one around the event horizon. Now, if we collect together, this is the basic idea from King and Ritter, and I'll just put this up to show the basic exponential decay of such a system, because you can't have the cooling front if the whole disk is ionized, and you get a secondary maximum when the when the material that's been irradiated at the outer part of the disk at the start of the outburst, that produces a mass pulse that comes in after a viscous timescale. You could do a fairly straightforward calculation of the radius and link that to how long it takes to come in, which of course depends on the luminosity of the source. And here, Chen, Schrader, and Livio made a superb compilation of the SXT light curves, and here's a collection of some of them, showing that one is dealing largely with these exponential decays, but sometimes you get a linear decay in here, and you can almost always see the secondary maximum. This is Nova Sco, which we'll come back to later on. And we took this one point further to show that depending on the orbital period, that you could divide the systems into whether you had an exponential decay in which the outburst was bright enough to have ionized the entire disk, or a linear one in which the outer parts of the disk are left effectively cool. And Nova Sco certainly fits into that category. Yes, in addition to the secondary maximum, some of these started with Nova Per in 94, show these reflares or mini outbursts, depending on what you want to call them. And again, this is from Eric Kulka's review. Below here is AO620, and certainly in the early part days of this field, it's possible that after the initial decay, people lost interest. Remember, in the source, remember this is all done photographically because these observations are almost 25 years ago now. But there is some weak evidence that the source actually did become active again, and that these reflares could then be associated with additional mass transfer triggered in the initial outburst. Okay, that's enough on the light curves of what we could learn. I'm going to skip X-ray spectra, of course, because that's Gene. And we've talked about the optical counterparts. Let's look a bit more detail now about what we can really learn from quiescent studies, and that leads into what Andy showed you briefly yesterday. A very quick, simple undergraduate reminder of measuring masses in binaries. Of course, in a classical binary, ideally you'd like to see both stars and have some constraint on what the inclination is. Although if they're not eclipsing, one rarely does. So all you get is the period and the k velocities, the radial velocity of each of each star in the binary. In SXTs, you basically have no information about the velocity of the compact object if you believe it's a black hole. Everything we get is from the companion. All we can get is the period and the k velocity of this. This is where one comes to the orbital mass function for the companion star, which is just defined as this combination of the observable quantities, which in terms of what you're really interested in is this. The key point and what makes the LMXBs so important in all this is that the where we believe we're dealing with heavy compact objects, possible black holes, MC is very small. And so if you put that to zero and you considered the inclination to be 90, then of course the mass function would equal the mass of the compact object. But if you relax either of those, because there isn't yet a single eclipsing X-ray transient, the best we've gotten so far is a partial grazing eclipse, and of course the companion star can't have zero mass, it's quite trivial looking at this equation to realize that Mx will then be greater than f of m. And in terms of reality, that is something that you cannot escape. The accuracy from the observations that gives you FM gives you the absolute lower limit for the compact object with essentially no other assumptions, providing, of course, you've got an accurate velocity for the companion star with no distortions. There are circumstances under which you can have a problem there, and I'll mention that later. Still, we really want to measure masses, and that's where we need additional constraints. The first one, of course, is that the secondary fills its Roche lobe. That's reasonable, since we know mass transfer is going on to produce the X-ray outbursts, and I'll show that we have evidence for the mass transfer continuing in quiescent. So using the classical Pachinski relation is probably a pretty reasonable assumption. You can, of course, combine that with Kepler's third law to derive the well-known result that gives you the mean density of the secondary star purely as a function of the orbital period, which gives you some idea of the evolutionary state of the stars you're dealing with. The second thing you can assume is that the secondary is co-rotating. They are close binaries, and so tidal forces will bring these into co-rotation fairly quickly. That means the rotational velocity projected on the sky is just, you know, the distance traveled divided by the period. You can combine that with this equation to get this result here, very simply. This is actually what you can observe if you can detect the broadening of the absorption lines, and I'll show you an example of that in a moment. This is the observed decay velocity from the radial velocity curve. If you can get that, and remember this will now require much higher resolution to detect, the only unknown here is Q. And so this was a result first used on some CVs, to my knowledge, in the mid-80s. Some work that Keith Horn did, but it's actually extremely important in this work here. Still, you still need one more parameter, of course, that's the inclination, and that comes from that, again, assuming that the secondary is filling its Roche lobe, you have the tidal distortion, which is basically a function of inclination only. That means that gives us the potential here for a complete solution of both the masses and the inclination, which is actually pretty good when you think that they're not eclipsing and you only see one star. But you do have these other assumptions built on there, and I'll keep reminding you of that point in terms of what one really has here. The first star on which this was done was AO620. This is its light curve again, X-ray and optical. But whilst at peak it was 11th magnitude, at times like this, 6 magnitudes above quiescence, you can't see the companion. And so it had to wait until it was in quiescence. And this was work done by Jeff McClintock and Ron Remillard, who is here, of course. This was the very first of the X-ray transients and to be done this way. And this is from their high-resolution observations at Kitt Peak in the mid-80s, AO620, and underneath it is a template star. For the theorists amongst you, again, this is a plot of such exquisite signal-to-noise. Every feature in here is real, as you can see in the bright late K star. This gives you the spectral type. It is a very cool low-mass star. And from that, they got this radial velocity curve for AO620. And using exactly the same technique, we did that for B404 Cygni, which this is the plot that Andy Fabian showed yesterday of the of its radial velocity curve. So from that, as I said, if you got the period and the K velocity, this is the numbers for V404. It's 6.1 plus or minus 0.06. So that is, given the lack of activity and the cleanliness of the absorption lines in this system, this is the absolute rock bottom that we are dealing with. Now, that radial velocity curve was obtained when we were doing high resolution spectra. In this plot here, this is V404, the sum of all of the spectra with appropriate Doppler shift. And at the bottom is a bright template star, in fact, which matches extremely well the V404. It's a K0 subgiant. But I think you can see even even the plot like this, that we have resolved the absorption lines in V404. We have to broaden the templates with about 40 kilometers per second to get this, and then you subtract it from here, and the residual is at the top. Of course, this region here is messed up by the residual H-alpha emission from the disk, but that's how one gets the rotational broadening. There are assumptions going in there because of what you have to do in terms of the assumed atmosphere of the star in terms of doing this broadening, right? And so there, that introduces some uncertainty, but still, the net result is to give you a Q value, which for V404 is 17. And with an error, probably not much more than about 1 in that value, which tells you that in this plot of the secondary star mass against the compact object, that the result must lie somewhere along here. The key point, of course, is that you don't know the inclination. So you would have to, this is inclination plots from 40 to 90. It's not eclipsing, so all we can say is it's got to be to the right of that, and a K0 subgiant couldn't be above here. That's how one gets those constraints. V404 and Novascope are the easy ones. They are the brightest. Okay, that's why the data looks superb. Everything else gets harder. Just to give you flavor for this, this is the hardest one we ever did from La Palma. This is G2000 plus 25, which hit below 21st magnitude at quiescence. Again, that's the top spectrum here, and various templates underneath it. And the K5 in the middle is the best fit to the overall continuum. And doing cross-correlation in this region with these absorption lines and in the calcium triplet region, we got this radial velocity curve on the 8-hour period, the mass function of 5. This is the one that's second only to V404 still. But that was with a 4-meter telescope, and these spectra of Alex Filipenko's were done shortly after ours with the Keck telescope. It shows the improvement in radial velocity accuracy if you go to a 10-meter telescope. And so for a lot of the systems that are being found now, that's what we need. One thing I'll just show, this is that same spectrum of V404, only now plotted so as to keep H-alpha on the plot. Because I did say that there's no radial velocity information about the compact object. Now you might say, but you've got this strong emission line, which you assume is coming from the disk surrounding the compact object. That is true. But you can see it's extremely broad, and it's very complex, it's double peaked, as you would expect with the accretion disk. This is the infrared passion lines, which shows a similar feature. The problem with this, there was a detailed study of the H-alpha velocities in quiescent transients done by Arroz et al. In 94, but that followed on from an AO620 study by Carol Haswell and Alan Shafter. And the problem is, although it's extremely broad, you could do various tricks to make sure you take out that structure at the center of the line and just look for the rate of velocity shift in the wings, which you would say are coming from the inner part of the disk. You can get a modulation. Remember, of course, if Q is like 15, it means that the compact object is moving 15 times slower than the companion star. That's why the transients are so good. The companion star is really nothing much more than a test particle. And you can get amplitudes that are sort of close to what you might expect. The only embarrassment is that almost all of them show a phase offset. And so the disk emission is not symmetric. Because of that, whilst the amplitudes are sort of what you'd expect, I do not use these. I do not recommend using them as a dynamical constraint, which is a pity because the H-alpha line is actually quite easy to see, particularly in the fainter ones. But that's a problem you should bear in mind. In that paper, it showed the mean profiles, and you could see that there are excess emission components, which are variable, even in systems from year to year. So you have to be very careful with what you can do dynamically there. So here's my current set of selected dynamical data for 9 SXTs, of which 8 are black hole candidates. The 9th is Senex-4, which I've left at the bottom here. I've talked mostly so far about V404 and G2000 and AO620. But I've got them in two groups, and that's because we have these two, NovaSCO and 1543, which are a significantly earlier spectral type than the rest. All of these are basically very cool companions, but these are A or F star companions with masses around 2. Now, of course, I jumped slightly there because the thing I haven't mentioned, of course, is the work on the infrared photometry, the ellipsoidal modulation of the secondary. This is a series of papers that I did with Tariq Shapaz and Tim Naylor over the last 4 or 5 years. And this is where we used that double humped variation on the orbital period that you get in transients, you get this in all low mass X-ray binaries. The only question is whether you can see it. Of course, the companion is filling its Roche lobe, and so you will get 2 maxima per orbital cycle and 2 minima. Remember that the minimum when you're looking at the inner Lagrangian point is slightly deeper due to gravity darkening. The basic idea, of course, is if you're looking pole on, the thing is just flat. You don't see anything. If you're looking at 90 degrees, you see this maximum modulation of a little under 3/10 of a magnitude. And all you have to do is measure that amplitude, and that gives you the inclination. That's because at these mass ratios, whilst the shape and amplitude are a function of the mass ratio and the inclination, once you get Q really above, much above 5, you find that shape is pretty much independent of it. So it really is giving you an idea of what the inclination is. And these were the results we got on the 3 transients that we studied first of all. And I'll just show you the actual light curves. We went into the infrared, of course, because as you've seen in the optical spectra, that strong H-alpha, the disk is still there. And so we wanted to, and if you're dealing with cool stars, by moving into the infrared, we wanted to maximize the contribution from the secondary star and minimize that from the disk. Nevertheless, there are still slight asymmetries. The AO620 plot required an additional hotspot, even in these are all K-band for these two and H for Centaurus X4. We did Cenex 4, well, I'll come to that in a moment. When you fit those, of course, you can see here that the inclination comes out as a function of the mass ratio, say for Q much above this region, there's almost no change with mass ratio. It could be infinity. But that is perfect because the spectroscopy, the rotational broadening, if you can get it, gives you the mass ratio because you have a very tight constraint here. So that's the importance of being able to detect that effect. And then this is where you get the 12 plus or minus 2, which, by the way, Andy didn't say is 90% in this fit error on the mass, and you get the mass of the secondary star, which is about half for V404 Cygni. That's how it works, and this collects together those in that table. So V404 is here. The reason we did Cenex-4 is we know it's a neutron star. It produced an X-ray burst during its outburst in 1979-1980. And using exactly the same technique, we didn't do any fiddling of the numbers. The compact object in Cenex-4 comes out to be between a half and one and a half solar masses. And so the errors are larger than we would like. We'd still like to get them down further. But the basic principle seems to be coming out with the right sort of answer. Now, I should say that there's been a lot of criticism of applying this to V404 Cygni. And you can see why, if instead of showing you the K-band, I show you an R-band-like curve that we got similar to the one that Mark Wagner did. In the early 90s. Yes, you can see an ellipsoidal variation, but for an object this bright, it's about 17th magnitude. The error on these photometric points is the size of the dot in here. And so there's an enormous scatter. V404's orbital period is 6.5 days, and so that's why you can see the thing blocked off into individual nights. This is from a two-week run. Yeah, we had 16 consecutive completely clear nights on La Palma in that summer of 92 to get this light curve. But within each night, there's substantial variability, which is on a time scale of like 6 hours. And the origin of this, we still do not understand. That's something I'd like to throw up for one of the working groups. That's one of the reasons we went into the infrared. But just out of interest, we did a piece of analysis on this, which was to say, well, let's assume that the minimum in this variation represents the secondary star. Everything else is something going on in the disk, the mass transfer stream or whatever. Let's just draw. I didn't actually do it by eye. We just took the average of the lowest 5 points in each bin and got a curve like this. And when we fitted that to the ellipsoidal curve, we got basically exactly the same answer as we had obtained in the K-band photometry. So I thought that was, so the inclination has to be something in the range of the upper 50 degrees. But the reason I show that is because a similar variation was found by the Texas group in their H-band photometry, although they only had 1 6-hour continuous run here, which shows that variation that we actually saw, but the rest of the data spread over 17 nights taken in a 6-month period. And they considered that the variability was contaminating that infrared light curve. And this is a problem that one always has to address in this kind of work. But still, how much of an effect is it? This is also from the Texas paper. You've got the Q is determined by the spectroscopy in here, and you've got the lack of eclipses and the hard minimum of 6.1 that you can't get below from the mass function. Depending on the amount of contamination that they included, you got results of either 9 or 11 solar masses. So they were bringing the mass of the compact object down by between 1 and 2 solar masses compared to our result. And that was why a couple of years ago we obtained the very first infrared spectra with CTS-4 on UKIRT of the companion star. And here's V404 here. It's really just worth looking at the top ones. And this is a K0 subgiant. The main features you see are the CO bands. And again, we did the same trick of seeing how much discontamination was left after you subtracted off the K0 subgiant. And when we did that, this is the fact that it's not eclipsing the limit down here. It really has to be to the left of here. We couldn't have any. We basically measured zero, but with an upper limit of about 15%. And so it's got. At most, you can bring it down by about one solar mass from the 12 to 11 if you take it at this worst contamination. But I see that as so far a vindication of this rather than an indication of any serious problems. Again, those of you who work in this field know that there is a problem if you do all this in the optical, as shown by this work that Jeff and Ron did in the 80s, and which Carol Haswell has discussed recently. In the optical, doesn't look quite as clean in that ellipsoidal modulation, but the main thing here is that here's a four-year average, 81 to 85, then 86 to 87, but then 86 to 89, the minima swapped over. And then swap back again after 89. Now, Carol has suggested that you might be able to explain this if, for instance, you had a relatively high inclination and a precessing disk. So here's the secondary, an eccentric disk, the kind of thing you would expect. I'll mention this in a moment for the such high mass ratio systems. And as the disk precesses, there are certain phases. You can get eclipses, and at other phases you don't. And that this time scale is long enough to produce that kind of effect. If this is happening, then our inclinations are wrong. Now, so far I don't believe that is the case. I think we have to find another explanation for that change in the light curves, because for this to work, you've got to be close to grazing eclipse. So you need an inclination of about 65 to 70 degrees. And we come out with something much nearer 40 degrees. So I'm afraid at the moment, I think in terms of consistency, I prefer the ellipsoidal analysis, which has come out with no contamination and no problem there. But that brings me to the analogy with the systems that produced that eccentric disk hypothesis back in the late 80s. And that is the SU-UMA systems. Now, those of you who've worked on CVs will know that these are an interesting subgroup. They're very short period cataclysmic variables. They're below the period gap. And they exhibit super outbursts, usually pretty rarely. When they do go off, they last a couple of weeks, and they display these odd features called super humps. I should show you what. That this is not. We're not talking about a small effect in CVs. Here's an example of a CV light curve with the hump here. It's a good 20% of the total light from one of these systems. But the key thing is that it marches through the orbital light curve, and so it has a period a few percent longer than the orbital period. And there was a lot of argument in the 80s as to what was explaining that, but it's now generally accepted that the model that Rob Whitehurst and Jeff Barth developed of an eccentric precessing disk explains virtually all the observed properties of the of these high mass ratio systems. The superhump is then due to tidal distortion by the secondary. When the disk is comes close to the secondary, the tidal energy dissipation is much greater, and that releases the energy that we see as the superhum. Now, what's the analogy here? Well, this mass ratio, and that is all of the SU-UMAs actually have mass ratios of 5 or so, or slightly higher, and all of those SXTs with cool secondaries that we've got the masses for so far also have Q greater than 5. I mean, in VFAR 4, its Q is 17. You probably realize I'm talking about Q, where it's the mass of the black hole over the companion star, which I know other groups of binary people do it the other way around, but I prefer to work with non-decimal numbers here. But the thing is that the high mass ratio implies that SXTs ought to show this effect. But how? And the problem here is that any tidal energy in the disk is going to be a small fraction of the enormous reprocessed X-ray luminosity that one has driven from the compact object if you think you're dealing with a black hole. So that was... this is, by the way, an unsolved problem in my view. It's exactly what causes the effect in... there's now been 3 well-studied transients during outburst which have shown this effect, and in fact, Darrow Donahue and I collected these the data together and reanalyzed it as a single group. By the way, just to show you the how similar the light curves are of these SU-UMA, or sometimes called TODES for the tremendous outburst amplitude dwarf novae. One of those is an X-ray transient. The other two are CVs. I've covered it up. And I think you'll agree it's actually pretty difficult to spot which one it is until you look carefully at the time axis and see that this one up here has a time axis measured in hundreds of days, and these are only tens of days. That's actually Nova Per. This is an SU-UMA system, and this is a WZ Sagitti or TOAD like. But the basic light curve shape is almost identical. Eric Kulkas showed this very nicely when he overlaid AO620 and ALCOM. They are both on that plot. In fact, they both show, if you scale it, this is for ALCOM, the top, this is for AO620 in time. The only difference is a factor of about 8 or so, 6 or so in the time axis. Otherwise, the features actually match each other absolutely perfectly. I think that's another thing to bear in mind. This shows the processing disk according to the Whitehurst simulations, and you can see it almost showing up as these spiral arms that move around in orbital phase. Here, I shouldn't bother with that. The actual light curves that are seen in the X-ray transients during outbursts, at certain phases, I might add, it's not a feature that's there all the time. And this is Nova Per 94 from data that the French group, Pilovaisky, Chevalier, and also Kato in Japan obtained. And you could see if the subsequently determined orbital period just is a very poor fit. In fact, if you extrapolate with the orbital phase back, you get an extremely bad fit to the... Okay. If it's because it's a highly non-sinusoidal modulation, just like in the SU-UMA systems, if we fit a three-term Fourier series, you can actually get a much better fit. It shows a very clean then separation between the orbital period here and the superhump period at a few percent longer. And that we found in, I won't go through all of them because I don't have time, we found in 3 of them. One, interestingly, in Nova Mars, the period in which we saw the effect was close to the secondary maximum, which coincided with an almost complete absence of hard X-rays. This is the hard over soft X-rays from Ginga, from Ebisawa et al. And the soft X-rays, by the way, are virtually unaffected by this, but the hard X-rays effectively drop through the floor at this period, at the time of the secondary maximum. I think that's another important property. Okay, I just mentioned briefly that and I have to confess this was discovered accidentally, was this the property of the lithium line that's in there, that when we, if you take off the best fit spectral type to V404, you're left with the disk, except we were left with this line that refused to subtract. And that was lithium-6707, because you don't find it in field stars, or certainly field cool stars, because, of course, it's destroyed by convective processes. And we then looked carefully at all our spectra and found lithium in all three of them, SENEX-4, V404, and AO620, all show strong lithium. I won't go through the arguments, but I think it's quite easy to show that we're not dealing with pre-main sequence stars here in the X-ray transits, unless the binary evolution people have got something completely new up their sleeves. And so you've got to therefore look some way of creating lithium in these systems. And of course, the massive X-ray outburst is the route to take. And Eduardo Martin and Jan van Paradijs wrote a paper on the energetics of this, which showed that the energetics actually work out if you create the lithium through spallation processes. And one possible piece of circumstantial evidence on this was found, this is in Nova Muscae, from the, gosh, it was the Granat observation, wasn't it, that on one day, Novomuz showed what at the time was thought to be the electron-positron annihilation line at 511 keV. But there were all kinds of problems with it. It was slightly redshifted. And perhaps that was a gravitational effect. But in fact, if you look at the line more closely, it almost looked like it was double-peaked. These are the two emission lines in gamma ray energies. This is 100, this is 1,000 keV up here, this is half MeV. And this could actually, we could have been seeing the spallation creation of lithium at that time. And, if that's true, then you shouldn't expect to see lithium in the secondaries in cataclysmic variables, which are 1,000, 10,000 times weaker. And we did that as well. And indeed, we just got upper limits in those which had very, very clear secondaries. And you can see here's SENEX-4 again at the bottom. You can see how we had superb quality data that would have been found. Okay, the last object I want to talk about for the remaining few minutes of my talk is Nova Scotia. And that's because it's actually slightly brighter than V404, and it's considered in many respects to be a Rosetta Stone, but it's thrown up many problems. It's actually got a relatively low Q, this means that the ellipsoidal modulation is sensitive to both Q and inclination in this system here. It also was found early on to have a high gamma velocity, and Brandt, Sigurdsson, and Podzidlowski suggested this might be the one low-mass black hole, because you saw in my plot that all the black hole masses are coming out to be in the sort of 7 to 12 solar mass region. But if you can have a black hole formed by accretion-induced collapse of a neutron star, you ought to have something around at the 3, 4, 5 solar mass level. And the question was, is this it? Now, I'm not going to talk about the jets, because that will be covered later. It's also different because it's actually very close to being a steady low-mass X-ray binary. Both the jet sources are extremely unusual. But this one is observable optically, whereas 1915 is not. It's completely obscured. So it also, interestingly, had, during one of its subsequent outbursts in 1996, had an X-ray delay from the start of the optical outburst, found fortuitously. And as you can see, a clear delay, evidence of an outside-in outburst in the disk. So the activity starting in the disk and then driving the X-ray outburst as expected. But if you look at that on a longer time scale, this is from the work of Rob Hines and the Sussex group, whilst the X-ray increased initially, as did the optical then declined. This is HST Fars observations. Whilst the X-ray was still increasing, which is a real puzzle, which there's not a clear answer to. This is a collection of results from the Hines paper, which shows the complexity of the spectrum in the optical, and the UV looks like a disk spectrum. The optical looks like it might be a radiation, but if it's a radiation, it ought to follow the X-rays, and it doesn't. And that's also shown quite clearly in these two beautiful X-ray dips the XTE saw, and the optical observed at the same time saw absolutely nothing. Rob suggested that there's weak evidence for strong P-Cygni in the UV emission lines, which could indicate a disk wind, and that was also alluded to in some of the theoretical simulations yesterday. We may actually be seeing large outflows from this in addition to the accretion. But even though there was that lack of overall correlation, at certain times they found a correlation with a delay between the X-ray and the optical. That's this. If you look at that feature there, you can see it's a similar feature here and here and here. If you do a cross correlation, there's about a 20 second or so lag, the optical to the X-ray. Whereas if it at that phase, that's less than it would have been the distance to the companion star. So they were looking at something that's going on in the disk. I'm going to have to move on very quickly. The quiescent light curves are gorgeous textbook ellipsoidal modulations from the work of Arras and Balin. Beautiful fits can be done, and in fact the system Novosco looks something like this. It does have a grazing eclipse of the disk and the companion. But they're in their fits, and this is I will warn theorists who use these results that when they fitted the inclination, they took this minimum in chi-squared, and this is where the plus or minus 0.08 degrees to the inclination comes. And we think this is wrong because this is actually a local minimum. This is the broad minimum, and you really are ought to claim perhaps only 1 or 2 degree accuracy. But in fact, the Amsterdam group also did photometry of the quiescent light curve, but indicated in their fits how you have to take account of the systematic uncertainties in the knowledge of the luminosity of the secondary star. We just don't have the distance accurately enough. And so you really can't claim inclination to 0.1 degree yet in an X-ray binary. But on the other hand, by any other standards, you still have a good constraint on the on the inclination. But the masses came from that from the rate of velocity curve, of course. And Arras and Balin got this value for k, which gave this mass function, which is the commonly quoted one. And then their light curve fits gave that. The trouble is the spectroscopy, unlike everything else I've told you this morning, was taken in outburst. And you have to be very careful here to look at the effect of the radiation on the absorption line strengths. And this is work that Philip Podzielowski has had his student Sam Phillips doing. If you actually look at the rate of velocity curve, you can see evidence for an eccentricity, which tells you you've got an asymmetry going on there. And so the irradiation must be a significant effect for this luminosity. Basically their fits are done with models that look like this. I don't have time to tell you what how they did that in detail. The net result is numbers are not around 7, but in the range 4.1 to 6.6, and this was quiescent rate of velocity curve gave a slightly higher value, but still in the same range. These are the sorts of errors you ought to be dealing with, and so there's still just a possibility that Novosco may actually be in a low-mass black hole. So I'll just jump to my final view graph before the chairman shoots me down. Future work that I think the working groups ought to address in here. One of the main things, of course, is we need a lot more of these systems if we're going to get a distribution of black hole masses and find out where these things came from. And also, we clearly need to go to much more multi-wavelength coverage, because we're gaining information all the way from the gamma ray through to the radio. So I will stop there. Thank you very much. Yes.
However, you've shown, for example, that in your reverberation analysis, you don't know the distance that you're eliminating, and you don't necessarily see the signature of reverberation and X-ray illumination in time dimension. One of the things we keep talking about is that in the ACM as well. Can you comment on
that? Well, that, I went over that very quickly, but that just detecting the time that they just detected the time delay of about 20 seconds or so. That's right. That's right.
And you know, quote unquote, that most of the energy in the distance
at that time is reprocessed. Okay, the rest of that paper goes into a discussion of what the emission processes could be. And you have to have several of them going on. And it was only during the period of the large X-ray variability they could detect any change in the optical. It was a very small amplitude effect. You've clearly got. Well, they were actually able to fit their spectra with self-absorbed synchrotron, so you've got a large emitting region because it is not eclipsed by the companion star. So the mapping is going to be extremely difficult unless you have coverage of all orbital phases. They only had a very small amount of data.
Right.
Correct. By having an extended emitting region, which is right. Yeah. That's right.
So the comment and the question: the six-hour variation of D404 signal is around a few percent of the orbital period. Now that's suspiciously close to the dynamical timescale of the Lagrange points, which it may have something to do with that. But the question is such a variation seen in any of the other systems?
No.
So there's nothing around a few percent of the orbital period.
No, we've looked for that in the others. It would, of course, be shorter, because V404 is the longest. The best one to study is AO620, because it's the next brightest. The other reason, as I sort of put down here, is that all of the secondaries in the of the cool ones that we've measured here have spectral types around K. You have orbital periods of, let's say, of the order of a day to 6 days. If you had there's a different group of people you could get in here who would say, oh, you're describing an RS Canven star. This is maximum coronal activity. This thing ought to be literally covered with star spots. And we've done photometry and spectroscopy trying to find activity that we can say that's on the secondary and that might be star spots, and we can't find it.
One more short question. Yeah. Yes. It happens that the principal luminous sources have secondaries that apparently are more massive than one solar mass. Do you think that is connected, that is could be a relationship between the mass of the secondary and the fact that these sources are repeated sources of the jets?
Better repeat that question, I'm not sure they heard it back.
Okay, Felix is pointing out, of course, that the two sources that produce jets, now it's possible this will be discussed later on, J1655 and 1915. 1655 we know is a more massive companion now. In fact, it's probably more massive earlier in its life. 1915, there's actually an enormous debate between people, some who think it's an LMXB and others, like us, who think it's actually a quite a massive system. The trouble is, the extinction to 1915 is something like 25, 30 magnitudes. So you only have infrared data, and it is circumstantial. But nevertheless, I think they both are higher mass. Those are the ones, I think Jean may be saying something about the X-ray properties to suggest why these are jet sources, and that could indeed be related to the fact that we're dealing here with a much more massive secondary. But I think that will come out later on in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Organizers put their enthusiasm for black holes by working twice into the title.